This just in, Greece is still in a whole lot of trouble. The Prime Minister went to Germany today to see what could be arranged. We'll tell you about that. We'll go out to the oil fields of North Dakota to see what happens after the boom. And Michael Lewis on what happens after you make a whole bunch of people on Wall Street really, really angry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 23rd of March. Great, as always, to have you here, everybody. We'll begin, as we have so very, very many times in the past couple of years, with Greece. There was a big meeting in Berlin today. Angela Merkel for the Germans, Alexis Tsipras for the Greeks, amid reports that Greece has only enough cash on hand left to last for another couple of weeks. It seems, then, an apt occasion for another installment of our semi-regular series that we call...
What's up?
What's up?
What the f***, Europe?
All right, so that is a slight change, as you might have noticed if you're a close listener, because really, what is going on over there anyway? We've got Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the line from London to do a little explaining for us. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
First things first, what do we know about this meeting between Tsipras and Chancellor Merkel?
He didn't get any money out of her.
Shocking.
Yes, but in fact... That was never in the cards for today, at least. I mean, that would be a decision by all 19 members of the Eurozone. Today's meeting was really about building bridges, repairing the incredibly damaged relations between Greece and Germany. I mean, it's the relationship between the two governments has become absolutely toxic in recent weeks. The Greeks have been incredibly rude and insulting about the Germans while asking them for some money.
It goes back, this disagreement does. I mean, World War II now is being brought up again in a substantive and not nice way. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, no, the Greeks have dusted down an old claim for reparations for Nazi atrocities against Greece during World War II. That has played very badly in Germany, because they say this issue was settled years ago. But also they feel linking the Eurozone debt crisis with Nazi atrocities is a step too far. Further, the Greeks have threatened to confiscate German property in Greece, including holiday homes, if they don't get their money. What's really enraged the Germans and indeed, actually, the rest of Europe was a threat from the Greek defense minister recently that Greece might open up its borders and let in a flood of illegal immigrants into Europe, which he said might include many jihadis. Well, that's gone down extremely badly in a continent that's suffered a string of Islamic terrorist attacks this year.
You know that old saying about how if you owe the bank $100, it's your problem, and if you owe the bank $1 million, it's the bank's problem?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you magnify that here, that's kind of where we are. So the question is, do the Greeks have any leverage?
The Greeks believe they have the nuclear option. They believe they've got their fingers on the button. They can default, crash out of the Eurozone, and they believe the currency union might then unravel, leaving German taxpayers nursing multi-billion dollar losses on all their loans to the rest of the Eurozone. But the German government has been saying quietly behind the scenes, don't you believe it? If Greece leaves the euro, the union won't fall apart. There are enough firewalls in place now to prevent contagion. And 59%, according to a recent opinion poll, 59% of the German public want Greece to leave the eurozone. So initially, a Greek departure might be popular in Germany. But the Greeks, you know, they're probably right. The German government wouldn't want to tempt fate. They really would prefer Greece to stay.
It's the whole face-saving thing, right?
Yes, and it's also it's fear of the unknown. Yeah. They really don't know what will happen if Greece does leave.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
My pleasure, Kai.
A little bumpy, a little choppy, a little this way and that on Wall Street today, then down at the end. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The corporate story of the day this Monday is of a corporation that's going out of business. Kinda. Radio Shack is on the auction block. Basically, all of the company's assets are up for bid in a bankruptcy auction this afternoon. The hedge fund Standard General will be there. It wants to keep about half of Radio Shack stores alive as smartphone stores, essentially, in a deal that it worked out with Sprint. And then there will be the liquidators who want to shut it down, sell everything, and lay everybody off. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains how it's going to work.
Bankruptcy is basically a company telling its lenders, I give up. Peter Gilhooly, co-chair of the insolvency practice at Latham & Watkins, says for some companies, think American Airlines, that surrender leads to a restructuring and relaunching of a successful business.
But with retailers, it is very common to have auctions to sell the assets.
That's because the problem is often at the level of basic business strategy, and the lenders decide they're better off cutting bait.
Radio Shack is probably a good example of that.
Gilhooly has done more than 100 of these auctions, and he says it literally ends going around a table with various big money investors choosing to stay or fold as the bids go higher. Bob Hansen is a professor at the Tuck School of Business who's studied bankruptcy auctions.
Auctions are wonderful mechanisms for determining a price and allocating a resource.
But bankruptcy auctions legally care only about the price part, picking whichever bid gives the lenders the, quote, highest and best price.
It's two different bidders associated with bids, maybe $1 million apart, $10 million apart. And one of those bidders is going to keep the company going, and the other bidder is going to sell off everything.
That's what makes this news. I mean, we just don't know, and people's jobs are in the balance.
Michael Pachter is an analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says another thing that makes this auction peculiar is that the hedge fund bidding to buy and keep some stores open in a deal with Sprint, it's also one of the lenders, which means it's looking to get paid back. To win the auction and save 9,000 jobs, it'll have to convince the other lenders this Sprint deal is better for them than just holding one big going-out-of-business sale. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
It's never a good thing for a company when one of its leading products is found to be, quote, probably carcinogenic by health officials. The World Health Organization said so the other day of the weed killer glyphosate sold by Monsanto under the brand name Roundup. Most of our corn and soybeans are treated with it, but humans don't eat all that much corn, relatively speaking. We do, though, eat animals that eat corn, cows and pigs and chickens among them. So, with that in mind, what do you suppose the cost factor is of a Roundup-free diet? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Brace yourself. Organic corn costs more. Catherine Green is an economist with the United States Department of Agriculture. Her figures show organic feed corn selling for about $11 to $14 a bushel.
That is substantially higher than for conventional corn.
Conventional, about $4 a bushel. But here's the thing. Animal feed is a relatively tiny part of the cost of our food. You know how many eggs you get from a bushel of corn? 478. That's less than a penny's worth of corn per egg. So triple that cost by using organic corn. It's like 3 cents an egg. So am I getting this right? More expensive corn doesn't mean higher egg prices? Bruce Babcock is an economist at Iowa State. He studies corn.
We did run this experiment where we doubled the price of corn.
And he's not talking about an experiment in the lab. This is the real world. The price of corn does go up and down, and you can see what grocery prices do.
It wasn't so long ago that we had $8 corn, not $4 corn, and people hardly noticed at the supermarket.
So why did I pay almost $5 for a dozen organic eggs yesterday? David Bruce runs the egg program at the Organic Valley Co-op. His members sold $50 million worth of eggs last year. He says organic producers do have other costs, and the distributor and the store both mark up prices. But basically, he says, I paid that much because I wanted them, and so did a lot of other people.
Demand is outstripping supply. You know, we're filling orders at 60%.
Meaning the distributor asks for 100 cases and the farmer says, I can give you 60. If the whole world went organic, there'd be more supply, more organic corn, more organic chickens, and the price would probably come down. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
We are 2 short weeks from the start of baseball's regular season, just 21 days from the home opener at Boston's Fenway Park. Whatever you think about the Red Sox, their home is rightly revered. Less well known, though, is the guy who keeps the field at Fenway in playing condition. Difficult in the best of times, downright a nightmare after the winter and the record snowfall that Boston has had this year. That guy's name is David Meller. He is the director of grounds at Fenway. Mr. Meller, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What does one do if one's a head groundskeeper and you are passed up to your eyeballs in snow?
Well, you know, this is certainly an interesting winter here in Boston, and our first choice was to use black sand to throw that on top of the snow.
Wow.
It absorbs heat and helps melt down the depth of the snow, and it's been very effective for us this year.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. What happens to the grass underneath when you've got this much snow on it?
Well, snow is a great insulator. It keeps the frost from going as deep, especially if we can get frost or the snow early in the season and it stays. As long as it doesn't turn to ice, it's very grass-friendly. Then it's just a question of how soon you have to play and removing that snow. But this is my 31st year in the majors, and five of the last 7 years I was in Milwaukee, it actually snowed the night before opening day with the Brewers. So there are times when you have to mechanically plow and shovel and do everything you can to get rid of it.
Do me a favor and give me your game day routine, because players famously have things they do every single game. What do you do?
Well, certainly, you know, the infield skin, where so much of the game is played, we spend a lot of time manicuring that, making sure it has the right soil moisture so that it's kind of like a cork board. So it provides the best bounce possible. We're repairing the pitcher's mound, the batter's box, the bullpens. We're mowing. We're manicuring edges. We're cleaning the track. We're cleaning sunflower seeds. It's a lot of attention to detail.
One of the reasons we called you was that we were talking to an editor of ours, actually, who is a Red Sox fan, it should be said. And he was reading something that said, Fenway's a really tough place to do the grounds because it's basically got three microclimates, right? You got the two basic ones that all of them have, and then because of the Green Monster, you've got a whole section of the field you have to treat differently.
Well, at Fenway, we get upper deck shade. We get the middle part of this field that gets sun. But the Green Monster, being 37 feet high and green, absorbs a lot of heat. So it's certainly our friend in the spring, fall, and winter. It'll help melt snow and warm up the grass in the spring and fall. But in the summer, that radiant heat is something we have to monitor to make sure the grass doesn't get too hot or dry out.
How does one get to be director of grounds at Fenway Park? I mean, it's a temple, for crying out loud.
You know, my job's the next best thing to play, and I'm very honored to be here. I grew up playing baseball. My dream was to make it to the majors as a pitcher. And a month after I got out of high school, I was hit by a car.
Oh.
I missed 3 years of college, and my family said, you need to find a career you're going to love to do, because so many people don't like their job. And during all my physical therapy and the many surgeries, I thought, what do I really like to do? What's my passion? I realized I love baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Science was a subject I enjoyed in school. I thought, somebody has to take care of a major league park. And I grew up a Red Sox fanatic. And to have the opportunity to come to Fenway has been a dream. This will be my 16th season at Fenway Park.
I should tell you, I grew up a Yankees fan, but we'll just let bygones be bygones.
Well, it's a great rivalry.
David Meller, he is the director of grounds at Fenway Park up in Boston. Mr. Meller, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up,
people are incentivized to do things that are not constructive, but they're paid for it, and it's legal.
Why, yes, that is Wall Street we're talking about. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 11 points today, less than a tenth percent, closed at 18,116, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 15 points, about three-tenths percent, finished at 5,010. The S&P 500 off 3 points, a tenth percent. Ended things at 2104. Told you about Roundup, the weed killer thing earlier in the broadcast. Shares in the maker of Roundup, Monsanto, as we noted, traded off nearly 2% today. Tenet Healthcare Corporation says it's going to team up with United Surgical Partners International with an option to buy that ambulatory surgery services company over 5 years. Tenet shares up almost 5% today. United Surgical is privately held. If you were looking to get in on that deal, too bad. The rail company Kansas City Southern cut revenue forecast. Seems the energy downturn means less demand for space on its rail cars. Investors thus put the brakes on Southern shares, down almost 8% today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the February Consumer Price Index. The Commerce Department reports sales of new homes during the month of February. And the National Transportation Safety Board begins a two-day public forum, Trains and Trespassing, Ending Tragic Encounters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. A glance at the still slippery price of oil, $47.45 a barrel at the close today in New York, will tell you all you need to know about the state of the petroleum-based labor market in this country. Some 75,000 oil workers nationwide have lost their jobs. Many more have had their hours cut. Inside Energy's Emily Guerin has the story of one of those workers on her last day in the Bakken oil field out in North Dakota.
April Boyce swings into the cab of her one-ton pickup on a chilly March morning. She's 42, tall, tough-looking, and pretty. She spent months driving this truck all over the Bakken oil field at all hours of the day.
And I don't really feel scared, except sometimes at night when I'm out in the middle of nowhere delivering to an oil rig, I could just come up missing because I'm just out there.
April is a hotshot, a driver who hauls equipment from one job site to another. Things have slowed down a lot.
I mean, it used to be that you get called out. I mean, you get called out at 4 o'clock in the morning and be doing runs until 10 o'clock at night.
Now, she waits by the phone most of the day. There are 80 fewer drilling rigs here than there were 6 months ago. That means less to haul around. We walk into the trailer office at Badlands Service Group, the small oil field company April works for. They do everything from welding to rig cleaning to trucking. She sits down at a computer and begins scanning in receipts for jobs.
Has that been signed?
It has been signed.
See,
that's April's boss.
Yeah, my name's Jim Levasseur, Badlands Services Group.
Today, Jim's workforce is 40% smaller than it was a few weeks ago. Jim's been cutting people's hours, and then a lot of them quit.
They're wanting 60, 80 hours a week, and if they're only going to get 40 hours a week, they're going to go home and work at their home. And it may not be as much money, but at least they're home every night and not sacrificing.
He doesn't blame them for leaving.
People get killed up here on a weekly basis. This is the worst conditions that I've ever seen is for working.
That's only part of why April is leaving. The other is the culture here.
He's got a well tomorrow, too.
We're at her going away party, and her coworkers are doing sake bombs.
Are you ready?
A week ago, April's boss, Jim, combined employee housing to cut costs. He asked her to move into a house with 11 young men. Not a comfortable situation. She looked for alternatives, but an average one-bedroom here still runs over $2,000. Her ad on Craigslist didn't work either.
And then I, you know, received solicitations for women, free housing if you're willing to trade, you know, favors for that. And that was it. There wasn't any legit, comfortable offers.
She tells me this as we head towards a coffee shop to wait for her to get called out on a job. While we sip our drinks, she tells me another reason, the real reason, why she's leaving the Bakken.
You know, it's been a long, hard road, but I honestly have recently admitted to myself, I have been running like a gypsy for 10 years.
10 years ago, April's mom died. She sold everything she owned, except her mother's cookbooks. She started bouncing from job to job. Oil field trucker in Colorado, cattle ranch cook in Wyoming. The job in the Bakken paid the best, but it was also the hardest and most dangerous.
And it took like the absolute grungiest, dingiest, darkest part of life to make me realize you can stop running.
The oil field slowdown has given her a chance to pause. 2 days later, April left Williston for a mountain town in Colorado. She talked about this town a lot. She's running again, but this time to a place that feels like home. In North Dakota, I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
Emily's story was produced for us by Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focused on this country's energy issues. We'll be right back. The stock market today did whatever it did. You heard me do the numbers. But the fact is, what we see every day on Wall Street is really only a tiny slice of what's actually happening. Michael Lewis took apart one slice of that slice last year, the very murky and highly technical world of high-frequency trading, microsecond transactions that let those in the know trade ahead of everybody else. That book that he wrote last year, Flash Boys, is now out in paperback with a new afterword about what happened after it was published. It's also in the current edition of Vanity Fair. Michael, it's good to have you on again.
Thanks for having me back.
Let me just read you back to yourself, since you put it better than I ever could. You say in the afterword to the paperback version and in the Vanity Fair piece, quote, "When I sat down to write Flash Boys, I didn't intend to see just how angry I could make the richest people on Wall Street," end quote. But who, boy, did you?
Yes, it was a byproduct of the story I wanted to tell, though, rather than the main purpose of it. The thing that gripped me was the idea that people on the inside of the stock market had found these problems, really deep problems, from which they could have made a lot of money, but instead decide, no, we're going to fix them in this kind of decent Canadian way. And I thought that was the story. The story was, what happens when a good man walks onto Wall Street and finds a problem? But of course, it irritated all the people who were making lots of money off the problem.
It irritated them, and in some way, both you and Brad Katsuyama, your protagonist in the story, became a symbol of I don't know what, trying to fix it, and then everybody gets angry with you.
Yes, and it's hard to know where it leads, because it generated so much noise at the beginning and seeming action. I mean, you know, Justice Department investigations, yeah, and FBI investigations and the New York Attorney General filing lawsuits. But it still all feels kind of less like a loud noise rather than any actual progress towards solving the problems in the stock market. What is gratifying is that the exchange that Brad Katsuyama created, the IEX exchange, which is explicitly a fair exchange where investors meet each other on equal terms.
We should explain that just a bit, right? So he built in time delay, so there's no front running, there's no HFT.
Right, so high-frequency traders who have a faster view of the market can exploit you, ordinary investor, with that faster view. They know the prices have changed and you don't. They can't trade against you at a stale price because he's built in this. He slowed them down. He created kind of a speed bump between them and his market. And his business, that market, is growing very fast. He's attracted big-time venture capital to turn it into a proper public exchange. Some of the biggest institutional investors in the country are now behind them. I think there's every possibility over a period of 5 years, 10 years, of market-based change. I don't hold a lot of hope of other sources of change.
That is to say, not regulatory change, not self-discipline change, all of that.
Well, you know, it's funny. You look at the SEC, for example. Mary Jo White, the head of the SEC, her first available opportunity, she went to Capitol Hill and said that there was nothing really wrong with the stock market. But at the same time, the former head of the Trading and Markets Division, the person at the SEC who oversees the stock market, just described the market as a death star. It just seems like they're having an internal argument, and it's hard to see where it's going to lead.
One more thing, and then I'll let you go, and I'll end the way I started by quoting you back to yourself, and here you go. This is the end of the afterword now to Flash Boys. That some minority on Wall Street is getting rich by exploiting a screwed-up financial system is no longer news. That's really depressing.
It is depressing, but if you go back to the financial crisis, what caused it wasn't really bad people. It was people badly incentivized, told that if they follow the incentives, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And this is that all over again. It's a very badly incentivized stock market where people are incentivized to do things that are not constructive, but they're paid for it and it's legal. I think that what we need to do as a society is, instead of demonize individuals, we need to look at what the incentives are in these markets and try to get them right.
That was the story of the last financial crisis, as you say. Is it also the story of the next financial crisis? Because surely there will be another one.
If you ask the protagonists of my book, they would say, this is the next financial crisis. It's going to happen. Oh. If the market continues to be structured the way it is, you're looking at the next financial crisis.
The coda, the afterword to Flash Boys, is in the new paperback edition by Michael Lewis. It's also in the new Vanity Fair on store shelves now, as they say. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kyle.
This final note on the way out today, forget basketball and the NCAA tournament for a minute here. My bracket is busted anyway. Let's talk football. The NFL is having its annual owners meeting this week, out of which have come two things of note. Item one, the NFL is going to suspend for this coming season its long-standing and much-hated blackout rule. That's the rule that had kept home games off television in local markets unless said game sold out 72 hours before kickoff. So there's that. Also, and more relevant perhaps for the changing entertainment times in which we live, is this. The league is going to broadcast one of its games this year, the October 25th Jacksonville-Buffalo game to be precise, online. That is, via YouTube or Facebook or whoever the lucky winner is in that auction. And just this note, when you consider that the NFL signed $27 billion worth of television contracts just a couple of years ago, it's an interesting move. All right, and that's all we've got. The Dow off 11 points today, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ down 15 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 lost about 3 points. That is a tenth percent there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.